Welcome to Androids and Assets, a weekly podcast about the political economy of all of our favorite science fiction and fantasy series. Join us as we investigate the hidden meanings in fantastic worlds and what the future can tell us about today. We upload new episodes every Monday. We hope you enjoy it. Hello, you're listening to Androids and Assets. I'm Steven, here with Marshall, your host, and we have, for the very first time ever, a special guest, our good friend Pasquale. He's a physicist. Say hi, Pasquale.
Hi to everyone. I'm here. I'm Pasquale. I'm just graduated my PhD in physics.
Yeah, and so basically, for those of you who don't know, we are a podcast that kind of talks about the social and political ramifications of various science fiction, popular science fiction franchises. So today we're talking about the 2014 film Interstellar, directed by Christopher Nolan. And yeah, I guess we'll just get right to it.
Yeah, this is going to be exciting. We're making our first foyer into sort of the hard sciences instead of the soft sciences that you may have become accustomed to at this point.
Economics.
Hey, it's a hard science. Hardish. Hardish science.
Then you shoot back psychology. No, come on. That's way worse.
So there's a lot going on in Interstellar.
It's long.
It's a long movie. Or at least feels that way. A big part of it is definitely the physics of it, where we see future physics happening. There's also, though, politics and economic and environmental aspects of the movie that we're gonna look into. So where do we start? Maybe environmental.
Yeah,
well, I think environmental is timely.
We'll set this world in which this takes place. So ostensibly, as far as I can tell, and I'm looking forward to maybe if you have a different interpretation of this, email us. But basically, as far as I can tell, it seems the world has been through a very catastrophic war, in which many people died. Like at one point, John Lithgow's character, Cooper's father-in-law, is talking about how he could, like, can you imagine 8 billion people or 6 billion people? You know, the concept of that is such a mind-staggeringly large number of humans. So clearly, it seems the Earth has been dramatically depopulated by a war, and now there seems to be a sort of conciliatory, pastoralized peace. Of course, all of that's threatened by this, what they call the blight. And then in a very offhand explanation, it's something to do with nitrogen, atmospheric nitrogenization. And so as the blight grows, this organism is environmentally engineering the planet to increase the nitrogen in the atmosphere and render sort of the traditional, the climate on which all human beings rely on useless. And also apparently has some sort of plant pathological impact. So like at one point they're talking about how like this year is the last year. All of the okra is now dead. The crop of okra is no longer exists. It's been extinguished by this blight. And so now they're all growing corn.
It's bad for my gumbo, that's for sure.
Yeah, without okra. So there's this clearly this, everyone, there's clearly an emphasis on agriculture now. And
I don't know, I think it's a byproduct of the blight, but there's other environmental sort of knockoffs that happen from this. They've got dust storms, we see they're playing baseball, and in the background there's a huge dust cloud that just rolls over them. So it's sort of like a 1930s, sort of dust storms that...
Well, that makes sense. If you have massive crop death, you'd have all these erosive forces. But I mean, on top of it, you have... The whole thing is framed. This movie is framed at the beginning and at the end with this, like, Ken Burns Dust Bowl documentary, pseudo-documentary, right? So it starts and you're hearing old people, you know, kind of like talking about they would have talked about the dirty 30s in the 90s, early 2000s. And so there's a whole... And it is very much a Dust Bowl scenario. So it's kind of making reference to this, like... Yeah, it's clearly making an appeal to the concept of the 1930s and the deprivation and poverty of that time. They really want you to think and look at it that way.
And I think a lot of the environmental aspects of this movie are in prescient in a way. And it's different than what we're experiencing now, but the fact that in this, what, past couple of weeks, we've had three hurricanes that hit Category 5, which has never happened before, major earthquakes, fires ravaging much of the world. Right now, this just feels like the Earth is not very hospitable, in the same way that the Earth of Interstellar is not very hospitable.
Yeah, and so I think very much, and this is kind of interesting, I mean, it's very anti-ecological in a certain sense, because it's like, the Earth is evil and trying to fucking kill us. We need to ditch it, you know, and then...
I don't think that that's an uncommon perspective, though.
No!
Humanity only perseveres because we're strong and we compete and we're always competing, and we even compete with our home.
Yeah, and this, yeah, I mean, this is the central thesis of the film, in a certain sense, that, like, you know, you have, like, the ascendant overman, this, what we've been having in private conversation calling soft Randianism, or maybe, in Interstellar's case, a very hard Randianism, that, a Reardon, John Galt, you know, like, a great, great, objectively great hero, who is so capable, and you see this very early on, the whole first part of the movie is just, it's just blowjobs for Cooper, who's played by Matthew McConaughey, how he's just like, oh, he's so amazing, he's such a great dad, and he's such a great farmer, and he takes all these, he takes all these old war robots and turns them into amazing combine drones, and he can just do and fix anything, and nothing is very hard for him. And he's so great. And the great tragedy here is that such a great man is reduced to the lowly act of farming, and he's been barred from attaining his true dream of flight, which is, of course, and Nietzsche talks about how the overman will fly, that's like a very, like, very, like, pointed reference kind of thing. So I think Nietzsche meant he'd fly under his own power because he had real bad syphilis at the end, but yeah, I think it's very much there.
And so then this sort of leads, I think, into some of the political aspects, and we've touched on them a bit so far. So there seemed to have been a devastating war a generation or so ago.
In Coop's lifetime, because Cooper is from the war generation.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so
Cooper's very clearly from the war generation.
Yeah, so not even a full generation ago, but within the past 20, 30 years kind of time frame. So not in the far past. So everyone's sort of still devastated by this war. But it did lead to a sort of peace when you have a huge number of your population knocked off. It tends to have a pacifying effect.
Well, there's this notion, like, embedded, like, one of the things we talked about, one of the things you see in the movies, like, there's this whole stuff about, like, how Cooper's son can't go to university because there's universities we don't need to be training people, we need farmers, we need pastoralization. All this thinking and aspiring to greatness and shooting for incredible impossible things only led us to the path of destruction. So it's kind of this, and you see, and I think this is where the ideology of the film really stands out, the notion that collectivization is sort of like just this, again, and this is the Randian piece, like, that whenever we collectivize, it becomes about the collective lowering of us all to some base level, and how we can only be at peace because we knock down those great among us. And this ties in the whole piece that it's, of course, is that really worth it?
So then when they're in school, only one student from a graduating class is allowed to go on to post-secondary. So you're competing very heavily. If you want to do some sort of post-secondary, you're competing against your entire class for that one coveted spot.
Yeah.
And the rest of you are just sort of not relegated. I don't want to make it sound like a bad thing, but you are breeders and farmers, and you're just there to keep the human race going, to get another great man or woman.
I don't think it's exactly that. It's this caricature of any sort of, like, collective social good, right? That, like, you know, so like the Nolans, I think this is, and this drives deep into the politics of Nolan. If we ever get around to doing Batman, this will, like, come out a lot more, I think. But this notion that, like, they're very deeply conservative reactionaries. Actually, when this movie came out, there was an article in Jacobin, my editorial concerns about Jacobin aside. but it was written by Eileen Jones. I think she's at Berkeley. And she kind of hit this, right? Like, that there's very, it's, the article is actually titled, and you can look this up, we'll put it in the notes too, Reactionaries in Space. is very much this like far right political conservative reaction, and you know, like, and that, yeah, sure, like, you know, these people have attained peace, but you know, what good is that peace if it would destroy the entire world? You know, and this kind of idiocracy of people, like that morons have basically taken over the world, and they all get along, and it's nice, but it's not what we need. We need people violent and tumultuous and who take what they want, and these wimps, this coalition of wimps that now rules the earth is insufficient. And this is where I think a gender piece comes into, in terms of Coop's a real man. You know, he's a real man. He just does stuff. He takes what he needs. And it's not, like, ultimately it's about depicting this caricature. I don't think this society is very realistic or credible, because it's just a caricature that is only to mirror and kind of bolster Cooper's credentials.
Yeah, and I think I fundamentally disagree with the idea that we should be competing for more education. It's pretty clear when you look at productivity and... I think it's pretty clear when you look at productivity and quality of life and happiness, people who have higher levels of education or who have more than just high school, productivity goes up, quality of life increases, society in general improves. So this competing for one spot probably actually reduces the overall well-being of society.
Yeah.
So they're saying, oh, well, we just need to make things better and not have all those eggheads who led us to war. But actually, having less education is more likely to lead to these negative situations in which people feel compelled to fight for something to have a slightly better quality of life. When you have more inequality and you have lower quality of life, you're more likely to lead to situations of war. So they're saying we want to avoid the situation and then putting in official policies that, to me, look like they would lead directly to the situation they're trying to avoid.
Yeah. Well, and this, yeah, and I think this is, and this is really driving at the way that Cooper and then kind of by extension the Nolans here are looking at things, right? So there's the quote where, like, Cooper says, like, we were explorers and pioneers, we're not caretakers, right? So the notion is that, like, things are changed by people who, you know, like, things are changed by people who do stuff and make things and take huge risks. And then there's these special snowflakes, maternal sissies, who want to take care of people and help them and make things good. And it's all, and that whole anti-education thing, this anti-education position that supposedly, this anti-intellectualist position that supposedly this school has, is just part of bolstering that credential.
For sure.
Yeah, but you're right, of course.
And then I also just question, more than sort of the overarching long-term outcomes of an anti-intellectual agenda, we know they have the blight, and it's a terrible problem for their crops, and they're losing things like okra and presumably other farm products. You would think you would want people who are more educated, who would then be able to think about how to solve that problem, whether doing some sort of scientific testing on it to come up with a cure or some way of just to have people think about, oh, it's important that we don't plant certain crops in certain places to stop spreading the blight. When you have people who are uneducated and just are like, oh, just put the seeds in the ground, that's when you had more spreading of things, you know, like clubroot. We didn't know about it for a long time, so we just planted crops and kept planting them. We're like, why do we keep getting clubroot? And they're like, oh, we should stop planting crops that are susceptible to clubroot, and then it will die and we can use that field again. But it took some testing and some knowing to get to that point. And if you haven't trained anybody to even think about a disease, then they're not going to. So even in the immediate term, it's not a good idea. To me, it doesn't seem like a good idea to just have this super anti-intellectual agenda. And I don't know if Cooper's farm is an anomaly, but he has basically automated all of the labor on his farm. He has combines that are completely roboticized. So we don't need the actual farm laborer.
Yeah.
But you probably want an engineer.
Yeah.
And you probably want a mechanic. and you probably want a computer science scientist to come and actually be able to maintain these products that you have on your farm. And it's not just a grade 12 high school education that's going to be like, oh yeah, I can maintain this highly sensitive piece of machinery on my own. This isn't a 1920s tractor that just needs a new fan belt. It's hot, like it's a computer that does everything for you. So they need educated labor to be able to handle these things. And then and maybe his farm is just an anomaly, and he's bucking the trend in being the Uberman.
Yeah.
But that just seems far fetched as well. That like his neighbors wouldn't be like, oh hey, you have a computerized combine. Can I get my hands on one of those?
Yeah, or that he couldn't like start making and selling them or something like
right,
that.
So yeah.
But here, and this is the but like this is the thing that's crazy about it. Like they at one I mean at the end of this the resolution of this movie is basically that Coop cracks all of space-time, the entire unified field theory, right? Pasquale?
Yes,
like
yeah.
we'll get to this later. But like the fact like it's literally easier to rewrite the entire foundation of the universe than to engineer a solution to this one particular organism.
Yeah.
which is crazy. Like, that's a crazy way to think about this.
Yeah.
So I think you're, and again, yeah.
And I don't think Coop is the only Uberman sort of archetype of masculinity. Dr. Brand, I think, would also fit in that mold in some ways, that there's a secret NASA, that he's been maintaining a secret research facility and going far beyond what anybody would typically allow, but just on the basis of his own charisma and uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
Well, I mean, this is maybe the only other kind of tacit explanation about the school, is because like where's all the money for the secret NASA coming from? And one of the things is they say like the universities aren't very big because we don't have the money for it. That's what one of the principal tells Cooper. He says, well, where's the money going? There's no armies anymore. Maybe this is potentially part of that explanation. No, there's not an army, but there is this secret
underground research facility. So there's that. There's lots of sort of there's a few masculine archetypes that exist that are the pioneers, these people
who are pioneers and not caretakers.
Right. Yeah. Yes. They don't listen to what the official dogma is that, oh, the moon landing was actually faked and we can't travel to space anymore. You have an astronaut who presumably has done it. That's what Cooper was. That's what his career was before farming. Yeah. Yeah. And you have Dr. Brand, who has a spaceship just waiting to go to space. So you have these people who know that it's not... That this is a lie, a state-sponsored lie. And they refuse to obey the state.
They refuse to toe the line.
Yeah, they don't toe the line. They're go-getters.
Yeah, well, apparently there's this great loss of technology. He also talks about how his wife died of a preventable cyst that could have been spotted with an MRI, right? It's like, we've lost. You know, it's just not that there's a huge technological loss somehow. There's clearly...
State Luddites.
Yeah, state Ludditism. Yeah. And again, which is why, again, I think this is an insane caricature.
No, absolutely, yeah. It's insane to think about. It's insane to think that we can get to that point. I don't think that it's realistic in a lot of ways that we could...
Well, mate, I don't know.
I don't think it's realistic that we're going to abandon MRIs.
Well, I mean, there is something which, like, the industrial capacity, and we could just lose so many experts, like, someone who could actually just be killed. That some of that knowledge could be.
But then we'll always have people like Dr. Brand.
Well, yeah. Well, why aren't you rebuilding the MRI machine? Yeah. How difficult is it to build an MRI?
Well, I know I'm a theoretical physicist, so I know the basics. I don't know how to put the pieces together. Oh.
I'm a theoretical physicist, not an engineer.
So when the war comes, we'll put a rifle in your hand. You'll be needed for building robotics.
Probably not.
That's it for me. Music from this episode has been from An Ant and an Atom. Thanks so much for your support.